I am so excited to have today as our guest one of my favourite people of all time. And this is Emma Bridgewater, who is the most extraordinary, imaginative, creative, entrepreneurial forces in Britain and the world today. And she's going to be talking in the presence of seven of our sixth formers at Wellington College. And they're going to be asking her questions. And we just asked them before we started, how many of them have Emma Bridgewater mugs or other products? They put their hands up in uniform, as you would expect. So, Emma, tell us, how did you, what did you think when you were the same age as these young men and women here today? What did you think you were going to be making of your life? And did you enjoy school?
I loved school. I had no idea what I was going to do. And I had a great sense of a lack of a vocation. I really yearned to know and get on with it. And so I did what a lot of slackers do, which was to go. I went to university and read English literature, for which I am so grateful. It's improved and increased the quality of my life every day. So don't be frightened of art subjects. Don't think that they're not going to get you anywhere in life. One of my grandfathers was very, very strong on this. Your education is for the quality of your life, not for the qualifications that are going to earn you lots of money. That's not the way to think about these things. And indeed, I tumbled into a career in heavy industry in 1984 when heavy industry was being systematically demolished. And I didn't really understand any of that. And I was certainly in no way qualified by what I learned at school or at university, not in any obvious way. So my destiny in Stoke-on-Trent was just an accident on the way, I thought, probably to work for a publisher. I pictured an attic in Soho where I'd be choosing the covers.
So what went wrong? I mean, just think of all the fame you'd have had and all the millions you'd have had if you'd gone into publishing.
Exactly. Certainly no millions from industry. I'd have had a so much less interesting time setting up a business and plodding away at it. I'm basically a one-trick pony. I had this revelation that we weren't making the china that suited the way my mum, who was eccentric and bohemian, her lovely kitchen. There was nothing in the shops that remotely reflected what it was like there. And not realising we were really trying to stop producing china of any kind, I got a train ticket to Stoke-on-Trent to find a potter. And when I saw the city, I was sort of bowled over with surprise and shock and excitement all at once. I could see the great names of Spode and Minton and Wedgwood. And they were all, and yet the place clearly, there were factories still working, but there was clearly a frightful sort of decline going on, which moved me unspeakably. And I couldn't bear the thought of this thing ending. And my sort of curiosity and my hunch about the fact that the industry was out of touch with the market, combined with a sort of feeling of I really want to save these skills, these people, these extra, and Soak embraced me straight away. It's been an extraordinarily powerful relationship, really, with the city and its traditions and its people, that has gripped me for 40 years. And I couldn't really recommend more highly the thrill of starting and running your own business. Sorry, that was a long answer.
No, it's a great answer.
You can cut it.
Brilliant answer. I was certainly not going to do that. I'm always fascinated by people who achieve great things, whether it's a sort of intuition, whether there's a sense of destiny about it, or whether it really is just a series of happenstances.
I think there's loads, and it's mostly luck and timing, isn't it? And then it's having a sort of personality quirk, which I definitely do. It's more of a condition of really, really dogged determination. I don't give up very easily, and I quite like risk taking. I'm not a sort of adrenaline seeker, but I always felt completely ready to back the project.
And what was it like succeeding in even more in the 1980s and 90s in a men's world, in an industry not always well known for female entrepreneurs?
No, it's quite an unreconstructed zone. I just flew completely under the radar. It was great. Nobody ever noticed me as I flitted about the city doing my thing. And they just assumed I was a decorator or someone's secretary or something. It was dead easy. I mean, by and large, an awful lot of the sort of drawbacks of being a woman are not to do with the interactions with men at all. It's to do with the fact that I've got four kids, that you're going to do something very exhausting, which is to pursue a business idea and look after your family. And it isn't just your own children. I mean, my mum, I looked after my mum and my little sisters and my granny and my handicapped sister. They were sort of they were just as important as everything else in my life. So that's the real problem, I would say, rather than men being beastly, because they're not.
And how did you negotiate that? Because some very successful women have done so at the cost of either not having children, if they were able to have children, or indeed rather ignoring their family and just being single-minded. How did you manage to embrace it all?
Well, I married a man who was very tuned into my career. After all, we'd met on my trade fair stand with a sort of riot of customers, and he beat his way through and sort of pretended he wanted to order some stuff. But so he knew what I was about and was very positive about it. And his mother was a very well-known designer called Pat Albeck. And so he sort of understood about women and work and saw that as a totally a good thing. I mean, there were times when the wheels came off, but his parents really put their shoulders to the wheel. They did a lot of childcare along the way. Matthew and I shared it. The children would have a lot to say about how neglected and ill done they were.
Price that in, that happens.
Yes.
That's part of
you've
being
got to price
parent.
In a lot of time later apologising.
Naturally.
Which is fair dues.
But you managed it, and you managed to bring up a wonderfully successful mother and daughter, and while all of this was going on, before handing over to the students, can you just give us a sense, Emma, what were the breakthrough moments? Because so many young people, including lots of Wellington students here and around the world and in other schools, would yearn to be successful in craft and design and in industry. Why did it happen to you? What were the moments on that scale, that escalated scale upwards?
I think there's, first of all, the vision in your own head of what's going to happen. And one of the pieces of advice I dole out all the time is the minute you can imagine in a sort of walk around it and understand what it's like, if you've got a vision of your future, and when I saw the derelict potteries in Stoke, that I knew I wanted to stand one of them up again. And my fate was sealed. So that was... In my head, I knew what the pottery was going to be like. I didn't know how I was going to make it or exactly what it was going to be like. I just knew where I was aiming. I saw Stoke and I thought, it's here and it's one of these factories. And then the key moment, the next one, was when I first put the first designs in front of customers, and there was a frenzy. And then there was, oh my gosh, it's expensive, which was great. So it meant they wanted it, but it didn't get out of control because I had no capital. I was working hand to mouth. The fact that it had to grow quite slowly because of the price was good. And I would say those are that. It's all early on that the die is cast.
And what is the design, last question before the pupils, what is the magic of the design? As you know, Sarah, my wife, would in our early stages of getting together would always give me a mark of where we'd been to. And she, like so many people, absolutely adores your work. What is it that makes it In the same way that we can tell what is a Monet or what is a piece of Beethoven music, lesser artist than you, Emma. What is it that makes it What is it that makes it recognisable as an Emma Bridgewater?
Well, that's the. I think that's the key first thing you do is brand. You really wrap your name around the product very, very closely and as emotively as you can, because you're, if it's any good, you're going to be copied. But what I was doing was channeling my mum and her tremendously welcoming, extremely informal life was inherent in the what the product is, what it looks like, how and where you use it. It's sort of, and when it's working, it's because it's hitting that spot. It's also important to say that what I was doing was decorating. I was sort of hand printing, and that the sponge printing goes on from strength to strength. But in marrying Matthew, when he came, when he battled his way onto my stand at Top Drawer all those years ago, he pretended he wanted to order the stuff. Actually, he really just wanted to get involved straight away. He was very, very, very sure that it was a really good project. And so this mug here on the table is designed by him. And we're sort of in, there are kind of two brands within. Matthew, he then elbowed his way into the business quite quickly and had a profound effect on the product.
And just tell us about this Albert Memorial mug, which is significant, Emma, because it was Prince Albert who designed Wellington College here in Berkshire and was the first Chair of Governors.
That's his significance to you. To me, he was the man who envisaged the whole of South Kensington as a museum complex, and the V&A is for me at the heart of that. And my darling granny took me there a lot as a child, and as a student in London, I haunted the V&A, and it had a huge effect on me. I mean, Matthew and I, our relationship, we're no longer married, but we go on talking, we talk incessantly, and the sort of whys and wherefores. All roads lead back.
Victoriana, that influence. Let's move over now. It's such a brilliant opportunity now. So where are we going to start?
Hi, Mrs. Bridgewater. I'm Neil. So your brand has such a strong sense of tradition and craftsmanship, but since the world's moved towards faster trends, e-commerce, digital marketing, and now even AI, what do you think young entrepreneurs today should focus on if they want to build something that lasts a long time, like you did?
Almost impossible question, Neil. But at the moment, I'm saying to the company kind of very as emphatically as I can, surely what we should be is the antidote to this fast moving life. Move slower, make it very clear how much we do by hand. And so I guess I'm interested in what AI can't do. What are the haptic skills? I hope that AI is going to take a very long time to develop, but I don't think it can ever build in the sort of the humanity that hand making and hand decorating has. I have no idea what the world's going to be like as you lot go out to work, and I feel both overwhelmed on your behalf, but also excited. The answer is, you know much better than me. To make it last, you've just got to love it. You've really got to mind about it. And if you think of your project as inherently and essentially financially motivated, I doubt it will last. Somehow, even within the big financial stories, there's a human story. And what's kept me absolutely kind of agog in the business, all it's 40 years now, is the people in Stoke and working with them and trying to make a real coherent future for what they do.
Neil, do you want to ask anything else, any follow-up there for Emma?
So you talk about how you currently focus more on the craftsmanship and nurturing those skills. For you in particular, going into a society where AI and, you know, e-commerce is growing, what would you do to keep your business sustainable and keep it flourishing?
Anthony, you say.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, that Neil's question there And how? And are you worried, Emma, that AI is going to take over from Emma Bridgewater and be better at being Emma Bridgewater than Emma Bridgewater is at being Emma Bridgewater?
It's a possibility, definitely. But I really hope that the people who will run the company in the future, and I'm trying to kind of stand back from it now and make sure that it has some kind of a coherent future, that they aren't rushing to use AI to do the designing and the making. I mean, I think identify the things that are better done by a person. We're not frightened of e-commerce either. I mean, we had a transactional website very, very early on, and being good at that is, you know, that's a set of skills that I think we've, I mean, you know, it comes and goes. You have moments when it's really flowing well, and others not so much, but that's a strong team, and clearly they've got their work cut out for them. But I feel my instinct is to focus on keeping the product as real as can possibly be, because I suspect that the more AI we use, the more we're going to actually be kind of searching for the things that anchor us and make us reassured about being alive and being human. Oh, by the way, call me Emma. Mm. I do.
Absolutely. Great start there, Neil. And we're now coming through.
Hello, Emma. Thank you so much for your time. My name's Nico, and I wanted to ask you, so you mentioned before the luxury premium pricing of your products, and I wanted to ask, with the speculation around the future budget with taxes going up, how do you think that will affect sales for you and generally in all the luxury sector, and how are you preparing for this?
Well, obviously my fingers are very tightly crossed. We don't know what lies ahead. And what I do know after 40 years is there's always something completely unexpected around the corner, as much positive as negative. You know, nobody saw the internet coming. How will this survive? I think high-priced special things have to be able to explain themselves honestly and clearly. And we as long as we can understand ourselves as aspirational, that holds, because the cost isn't, there's no profiteering in it. It reflects the costs of using more, you know, human time in production. And as long as we're explaining that whilst making something that people, even if they don't know about the making, just instinctively want when they see it, it's very hard to quantify what are the products that will justify their pricing and go on being attractive. But it's, so you're talking about the magic of branding, the magic of design and marketing. It's got to be Absolutely. Really epically good at all those things to survive. And it's going to be tough. It is already quite tough.
Hi, Emma. I'm Theo. So I saw that your most recent financial results mentioned losses tripling, but also noted that the business is improving. So what change been made internally to return to profitability and maximise it?
Good wow. question, and well done for looking us up. There's quite a lot of politics in those figures, because we've got investors involved in the business, and there's quite a lot of changes. And we grew terrifically in lockdown, and then there was quite a significant sales drop during the year of the Queen's platinum jubilee, and then her tragic death and the crowning of the king. So that kept us quite busy, but underneath that our sales were just adjusting to something like before. We're still way above where we were before COVID. But if you employ a lot of people, it takes ages and it's very expensive to downsize. And that's obviously why people don't do it. I just see it as, I've been through several recessions. I think we were too slow. Ideally we'd have cut costs much faster, which is what's happened since. So really, really good financial control is something that each time I think we've got the best, I realise when the next one comes along, there's really, really good financial control has made a big, big difference. And perhaps more sort of clarity of intent to make a margin, because for me, I don't think I chased that quite hard enough. It wasn't a sort of primary concern. Whereas the growth, the strong growth urge was partly sort of just came about with COVID, but with investors, they want that growth. So we're sort of putting ourselves under pressure. And that's kind of, you know, the whole thing is, it's interesting, but it's not frightening to me at all.
Had you been employed by Emma Bridgewater, is there any advice that you would give? What would you have been doing?
Well, I was also similar to that. I was wondering if it's because of inflation and rising manufacturing costs. Has that also affected your like pricing strategy
awful,
and like your
yes.
customer base based off of like?
Well, you scurry around in all directions, trying to offset the fact that every single cost is going up. So how can you work smarter? How can you so multi-skilling across the factory so you can move people around sort of ever more nimbly. And initiatives like that are now kind of much more vigorous, I would say, than they have been. And trying to identify that there are some jobs that we should probably mechanise because they're not very nice jobs and they cut quite a lot of costs. So you know, you do what you can. You do the normal things. Try and save money.
Brilliant questions. And how many of the seven of you see yourself going into manufacturing, which used to be so dominant in Britain and with basis of the British economy, rather than services? Any of you are considering going into hands up if you well, we're going to put half there.
There's nobody.
Well, I was trying to do my bit.
I'd make a case to say that employing people has been the biggest privilege of my life. And dealing with the unions has also been far, far more complicated and much less harrowing than people sort of made it out to be. And I saw union politics in the 70s. My dad was a publisher and he wildly, optimistically thought he'd get the deliveries of the books sharper if he bought the print works. And boy, did he, and the print unions were the most militant. And he took me with him, I think, for protection as a 15-year-old. And I saw them effing and blinding at him. And it was, they're violent. And so when I got that, I dealt with it without, it didn't feel frightening. So the whole business of employing people, I have a huge appetite for. And I also think that making things rather than just shifting money around is quite important. What is an economy if we don't make anything? And what would it be like to be a country that couldn't even make the plates that we eat our food off, which we're only a few potteries away from? I find that just like a freakish thought.
And
I'm not
sure that these magnificent seven, they'll see the light as a result of what you are saying. Brilliant questions. Let's go on to the next question, please.
Hello, I'm Luca. Two questions and one from me. I was going to say, firstly, what does it mean to you to be an entrepreneur? And secondly, what characteristics are required to be a successful entrepreneur, in your opinion?
I worked out that I really hoped that I was going to get married and have lots of children, and therefore I wanted to spend my 20s building a business that I could then come and go from. Obviously, that was fairly ironic and slapped me in the face for the next 20 years, but it is now the case. Because, of course, it's just endlessly demanding. And yet it does give you a freedom, which is particularly valuable as a woman if you're going to have children. And I know we should all now expect that the work involved in having a family will be shared by both partners. But it does still seem to fall. Obviously, you guys are going to prove that this is not the case in the future, and you're going to make sure you see. But being an entrepreneur gives you a lot of freedom and a lot of agency in your own life, and I'm the person that really, really likes that. And what was the second part? What's it like? What defines an entrepreneur?
No, what characteristics do you think are required to be a successful entrepreneur?
It is a form of madness because there has to be a lot of self-belief in it. I'm not sure where that kind of segues into all kinds of tricky. I mean, it's an obsessive business, and I sometimes feel I've been like the ancient mariner of the pottery is just so boring about it. But I think unless you're very, very, very emotionally bound up in your project, you're probably not an entrepreneur. And the ones that, I mean, there are serial entrepreneurs who are good at, which I'm not, I'm just the one trick for me. Clearly, the function of an entrepreneur of turning an idea into a business, fascinating. I have no insight into what it would be like to do that over and over again. But it's a creative process, and it's incredibly satisfactory to turn an idea into a human organization, a product.
Building on Luca's question are there particular entrepreneurs, Emma, that you've had in your mind who've inspired you? We know how important role models are in everyone's career. I mean, either entrepreneurs or indeed design, people who've had the flair with design.
I live with my head in books so much that my role models are probably more kind of Georgette Heyer heroes. And in an odd way, I think probably the physical role model was Laura Ashley, whose business...
Can you say a word about Laura Ashley?
Printed the epitome of romantic floral printed dresses with kind of very nice simple lace and I'm making them sound terrible. I don't know how to... They're a kind of rural vision of a sort of lovely romantic way of being. Lovely prints and a very sort of dreamy quality to it. And I loved those dresses so much as a teenager that I was quite aware of her career, which was a kitchen table business, that it goes on now, but it's not remotely like, doesn't reflect what it was like in the 70s. And when she died and the business was sold, and it's since been a very different thing, and I used to worry that that would be horrible for her children. But then I realised that what she did was to make this wonderful body of work. And I feel that about what Matthew and I did, that it doesn't really matter what happens next. I very, very much hope that the business goes on. Even if, like Laura Ashley, it goes on in different iterations. That's not a very good answer, is it?
It's a great answer. And did you ever meet Laura Ashley?
No, she and Bernard were friends of my parents, but I never did. But I do know her kids and her grandchildren a bit, and I know that it's very large in their lives, but it's not negative.
Yeah. I mean, your mums and grandmums will have, without any doubt, have worn Laura Ashley dresses. They were just everywhere. Okay, coming around to the next question, please.
Hi, Emma, I'm Ru. I just wanted to ask you, when you started, did you have sort of a typical Emma Bridgewater customer that you wanted to sell to? And since 1985, how has that changed, if it has changed?
That's such a good question. I didn't do any market research except to make some samples and put them on a market stall and see the reaction. What I was doing came from inside me with a strong feeling of being an homage to my mum, a kind of recreation of the mood of the kitchens I grew up in. So the customers just, when I'm designing, I'm trying to make a sort of personal connection with people who might like the same things that I do. I don't think, I'm really, really, I have great aversion to the idea of having sort of groups of customers and giving them a sort of characteristic pretend name and segmenting your market like that, which is all kind of totally conventional marketing speak. And but it's not how I function. But what happened was in doing that, it reaches out in a way that I do find completely entrancing and still completely mystifying, which is that I do deal with royalty and rock stars and lots of people who are saving up I was at a car boot in Norfolk recently, and there were a whole lot of amazing women who, one of them, they were all looking after one of their friends, nurses, who she'd been made redundant, and they were all helping her blow her redundancy money at the car boot, mostly on my staff. And the feeling that it's what she wanted so badly, and it being in sort of all sorts of houses all over the world, that feels really exciting. And I'm not quite sure how that happens. In a way, I don't think I'm meant to know that. Brand specialists are supposed to analyse that and work it out. I just did what I knew how to do. So you don't really aim at a market. I didn't. I aimed to be true, to tell the truth, to really try and think of you. What you might want to give your mum. And being the oldest of lots of kids, I'm the oldest of eight kids. You know, I think I try and do it on very, very human terms. It's trying to design based on real things, which is why I end up talking about finding inspiration in the natural world all the time. What are the things that connect us? What are the things that we all feel? And they tend to, family and love of your family is pretty fundamental. And I think it's often the way the product works, the fact that it isn't just mugs, it's plates to lay a whole table with, and it's jugs and dishes and teapots and all that. It implies a family life that I think we can all connect to. It works because it's emotional, I think. It's being honest and real.
Such love for your work is evident.
Do you think that's in proportion to what you put in? Sort of understood it.
I think you put your heart into something.
Yeah.
Heart talks to heart. Mm. And emotion to emotion, yeah. And I think it brings out the best in people. I think good design, beauty elevates people and makes us more.
But good design that's friendly too.
Yeah,
I think of it aspires to be a bit sharp and kind of cool. We're definitely not cool.
Love that. And
Cece,
hi,
you've got to do a lot of talking for the girls now.
You expressed earlier, and also in My Business, My Journey, that it's your unusual opinion in learning that being a woman in business is useful. Mm. Because so many women find it difficult to be a woman within the business world and environment, how do you take kind of flying under the radar and use it to your advantage?
quite a lot of long walks. I'd say that jokingly and not jokingly. A marvellous woman came to stay because her husband wanted to talk to mine about illustrating some books for him. And turned out she was headmistress of, I'm just trying to remember, a big girls' school, and finding it very stressful. And she said, don't worry about me. I'll just go for a walk. And she said, I'll walk probably most of the weekend. And I was really interested and sort of sidled up to her and basically forced myself on her and walked with her. And she said, you cope. She said, I cope with the stress of my work life by making sure that I walk back home to myself every evening before at the end of the day. And then some more walking at the weekends. And I realised I needed to walk back home to myself. I probably hadn't been home to myself for many decades at that point. So how do you cope with the stress of it? You have to look after yourself in ways that I didn't. And I would really, really like to put across to women in business to take it up from day one. And I talk to my daughters about it a lot, that I come from a family where there was never very much a kind of emphasis on looking after yourself. It was just sort of, push on. Rarely managed to wrangle a day out of school, out of my mum. She'd make me go. I absconded sometimes and she didn't know, but her line was go to school. You can push on through feeling exhausted. You can, you'll be fine. Have an early night sometime next week. And I worked like that and lived like that for a long time. And I realised along the way that you've got to be more systematic about and I'm sure it goes for everybody, finding yourself again, you meditate because it's where you remember who you are every day, because you can go a long way away from yourself. I wish I could remember her name. It was such a good, it was such a useful expression, walk back home to yourself. But you probably meant more than that. Ask me some more.
Come back on that.
In terms of the original question, I think I was more, I mean, it's very useful to know like the kind of discipline that you took from your childhood and took it into your business. And I think that's really important. But I think I'm kind of also asking it in terms of women in like a high level of business, maybe being, you know, overlooked.
Okay, this is a world created historically by men, for men, and we did play a very kind of secondary role. And it felt as if the female equality bill in the mid-70s changed that forever, job done. But actually, of course, we're still, it'll, you know, for generations to come, we will be moving towards an equal society. I don't know what any of you think, and whether you're planning to play a full 50% role in domestic life. But without that, women do have a difficult time. But I think that, but I think you, here you are at this fantastic school with all these nice chaps around you. You know how to hold your ground. We've got to learn to do that. And then sometimes, I mean, flying under the radar is also quite helpful when you're not feeling up to, you know, oi, don't talk to me like that. Just disappearing is also quite handy because you can just look, you can be invisible. But yeah, of course you have to stand up for yourself.
How are you going to do that, and how confident
yes.
are you
yes.
That you are going to hold your own? Is it going to be a man's, still a man's world, more maybe than for your
Do you think
parents?
You're changing that?
Yeah.
I think it's definitely a changing world. I think obviously there's still difficulties entering certain fields for women, even though, you know, from high up people are trying to change that, you know, employment. But I think kind of it really depends in the way that you look at it and the way that you're brought up. I know for me, my family have always made sure that me and my brother get the exact equal opportunities. I've never ever felt like I can't do something just because I'm a woman. And I think it definitely depends the environment you're in and also the environments that you put yourself in.
Yes, yes, good thinking.
You take that into your professional
Well, one career. Of the ways through is to make your own business, within which you can put a lot of emphasis on making it work for the women in the business, which it, we're B Corp registered, and I thought that was going to be hugely about environmental discipline. Turned out, when we did the audit first time round, we needed to be much better employers, and particularly of women at different stages of their lives. So it's ongoing. It's ongoing. But the moment of truth, just to be really simple about it, is when you go home with your first baby. Because it never crossed my mind through school and university that I wasn't 50% absolutely equal. It's yours and mine, mm-hmm. buddy. It's not yours. And whoa, you're holding a baby. And suddenly, it's all happening without you. And renegotiating that with only moderate success over 30 years of marriage. It, you know, that's the sort of the bottom line is, how are you going to manage your domestic life, or are you going to sacrifice it? Which definitely some of the women who are really flying high are
and to answer,
without children.
To answer for you all, to answer Emma's question, provocation to you, how many of you would actually be willing to play a full and equal part bringing up children as part of a family?
Well, look what a nice young man you
this
are.
This is Wellington. Very impressive. Final question coming up now.
Hi, Emma. I'm Walter.
Walter.
Earlier in this interview, you said you wanted to step back from the day-to-day running of the Emma Bridgewater Company. You said something very similar in an interview earlier this year. You said you had other ideas on the go that you'd like to pursue. Can you give us some insights?
Great into final question.
That was very, very cunning of you. Oh, God, I wish I had a properly developed answer for that, but I don't. My main aspiration at the moment is this walking thing that you know, you'll know that Anthony's very keen on, is to get out and kind of recalibrate. Because there, I think in all of your lives, but speaking as a woman, the third third is quite challenging, that, you know, which is where I am. And it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be to just sort of start something else. And I am still, there's still quite a lot going on in the business that I do have to do with. So although that's clearing and changing in a very nice way, I definitely shouldn't talk about the plans I've got, because I can see how hard it's going to be to get myself into that same early state of kind of reckless self-confidence that it seems to take. But I mean it when I say that walking, I did a long walk on my own, 250 miles from Southampton to Canterbury by way of a pilgrimage. And it was life-changing and completely fantastic. And is an ongoing sort of theme for me of making sure that I do find my equilibrium and be, whatever I do next, do it in a very kind of careful, kind of full-hearted way.
Thumbs up there for pilgrimages. Mm. And I hope Emma, as we talked about before, is going to join me on the final stage of the walk to Kyiv. And
I'd love to do that.
I'd love to have you. Guys, you have all been absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have any final questions, because I can't.
No, the question was nearly as good as the brilliant questions
that you really have asked. Thank you on behalf of us all. Emma Bridgewater, much loved national treasure. Thank you from all of us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was so nice talking to you all. And really good luck. And I hope some of you do start businesses, maybe manufacture things. Get good at changing nappies when the time comes and all that. It was lovely to meet you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.